Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Chris Neese, and I, along with my colleague, Elizabeth Fessler, have the privilege of representing the appellant in this case, the natural mother. Your Honors, this case is a case about a woman in the process of turning her life around. And the major motivational factor for her turning her life around is her belief that she can retain or get care, custody, and control of her two minor daughters. As this court knows, in Jackson County Family Court in November 2016, following a two-day trial, the Jackson County Family Court terminated my client's parental rights to her two twin daughters, and in so doing, applied an unconstitutional presumption of unfitness. Now, this presumption is codified in the Missouri statutes at 211.447.5-6BA. And it is that presumption that brings us before the court today. In my time before the court, I plan to do two things. One, I plan to demonstrate that the presumption is unconstitutional under both U.S. Supreme Court authority and authority from this court. Second, I plan to address the lack of clear, cogent, and convincing evidence to terminate my client's parental rights. So let's turn
again
to the
in the latter, you mean under the other grounds?
Yes, ma'am.
Because if any one ground is supported, then the judgment will be affirmed.
Yes, Your Honor. It will be under the other 211 grounds specifically. So let's turn to my first point, the constitutional challenge. There can be no dispute in this courtroom that my client has a fundamental constitutional right to care and parent her children. It's guaranteed to her by the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 10 of the Missouri Constitution. In fact, this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has referred to this right as one of the most fundamental rights we have as citizens. This court has likened a termination of parental rights to a civil death penalty. And because of that, when you have any infringement on this right, like we have here with the presumption, it must be evaluated under the strict scrutiny standard, meaning the procedure has to be narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. Often in the cases, you will see it referred to as the least restrictive means. Your Honors, it's the appellant's position here today that there is no way you can have an evidentiary presumption in a termination of parental rights case that shifts the burden to the parent to prove their fitness. That cannot ever withstand constitutional muster. And the case of Santosky versus Kramer is instructive on this point. It's a 1982 decision from the United States Supreme Court. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court established the clear, cogent, and convincing evidentiary standard in termination of parental rights cases. New York had a fair preponderance of the evidence standard. The Supreme Court said that did not meet constitutional muster. And in doing so, the Supreme Court looked at three important factors. The first factor was, what is the private right that is at interest? Obviously, the right to parents one children is one of our highest and most protected constitutional rights. So they checked that box. Second, they looked at the government interest involved and acknowledged that the government interest was significant in protecting children, but that interest paled in comparison to the fundamental right of parents to parent their children. So they looked at the third factor. What is the risk involved in the procedure proposed by the state? And this is the factor that's critical to our analysis of the Missouri presumption, because the court in Santosky told us that the risk is significant when you have a fair preponderance of the evidence standard, and looked at how these cases usually play out in the courts. The Santosky court noted that usually, on the side of the parent, you will have an uneducated, poor, often minority individuals that cannot match the resources that are brought to bear by the state. cannot match the resources that are brought to bear by the state and private individuals like we have here when they're brought in combination. You also have a subjective determination by a trial judge, a subjective determination that could possibly be subject to cultural or class bias.
Are you referring to a subjective determination as to the trial court's ability to determine the truth of the evidence and what the facts are?
Yes, ma'am.
That apply in every single case we have that we give deference without question to the trial court's determinations?
I would argue that a termination case is different, and this again comes from Santosky and what the U.S. Supreme Court was saying, in that you have the imbalance of equities in these cases. Typically, you have multiple resources or a lot of resources on one side versus very few resources on the side of the parent. Often the parent will have someone appointed for them to represent them.
And how does that concept interplay with the fact that under the standard of review, we give deference to the trial court?
I understand, and deference should be given to the trial court judgment. We wholly agree with that. But in reviewing this case and in reviewing the constitutional issue, obviously it's a de novo review, but when you're looking at termination of parental rights cases, the question is it supported by substantial evidence?
Correct. In the light most favorable to the decision.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why, because you give that deference to the trial court judgment, that's why you have to have the safeguards in the trial court. That's why you have to have that clear, cogent, and convincing evidentiary standard. But in this case, under the presumption, you no longer have the clear, cogent, and convincing standard. You, in fact, jump over the fair preponderance of the evidence standard and move to a standard where the burden is placed on the parent.
So we're the only state in the union after Sandusky that has this right.
No.
Right.
No, we are not the only state in the union.
So these other states are also non-compliant with Sandusky, right?
There are some states that are not compliant with Sandusky. Now, we cited in our brief two cases. West Virginia, the West Virginia Supreme Court has ruled on this, and the Florida Supreme Court has ruled on this. Both courts ruled that a presumption of unfitness, like we're talking about here today, is unconstitutional.
And there are other states that have ruled the other way.
Well, we have two other states.
Minnesota?
We have Minnesota. And in the Minnesota case, when you read that case, it's clear that the appellants were more focused on the procedural issues involved in the case. In fact, their challenge was that the procedures put into place removed the ability of the appellate court to determine if resources were provided for reunification. That was the real issue in Minnesota. Then, as a secondary issue, they brought a due process claim. But importantly, in that Minnesota decision, the Minnesota court said appellants did not even fully brief the issue. And the opinion does not make it clear that they were apprised of Santosky and all of the other Supreme Court authority that demonstrates this is clearly unconstitutional.
Would you address the other grounds for termination? Because if the other grounds for termination are supported, then the court might not get to the constitutional issue.
Yes, sir.
So I want to make sure you have an opportunity to address those.
Yes, sir. And let me just say this as I get into the other grounds. There can be no question that this presumption permeated the way the court decided the case. It permeated into all of these other grounds. And I have examples that I can point to. In particular, on page 6, when evaluating the appellant's challenge that the respondents had failed to prove the current mental health of my client and that her mental health was a barrier for her parenting, the court commented that the appellant should have affirmatively gone and sought testing to demonstrate that she was a fit parent. She should have gone and done that. That's not her burden under a typical case, Your Honor.
But that wasn't based on the presumption.
That is how the presumption permeated the decision. If you look at the way the judge wrote the opinion, he set out the various grounds under 211 and then at the end mentioned the presumption. However,
There was evidence of two different mental health examinations over a 3-year period, and the last one about a year before. And was the court indicating that it, all those had shown mental health problems during that period of time, and then he could see her testimony at trial, which he found confused and so forth, and from that concluded that she had continuing mental health problems and was noting that she had not brought in anything to indicate to the contrary. Would that be improper, or is there something to indicate that is not what the judge was doing?
As noted, the judge put the burden on her to come up with a psychological evaluation that she could have.
But you're saying burden. I'm saying was he putting an actual evidentiary burden, or was he noting she had not countered the evidence he had before him?
It is our position, reading the opinion, that it is an evidentiary burden. But to address your question regarding the other evaluations, the two psychological evaluations, one in 2012 and one in 2015, Your Honor, I submit that under this court's decision in NRACW, those two psychological evaluations are not enough to demonstrate the mother's current mental state. And in particular, when you look at the 2015 evaluation, my client was uncooperative. She had just started in the group home, just started getting her therapy, and just started to become medically compliant. And the evidence demonstrates in this case that from that point forward, she made tremendous progress. Her therapist, Donna Dixon, wrote in her report that my client had made tremendous progress. On the stand, when I questioned Karima Luster, the caseworker, I asked her point blank in her parenting, had my client made tremendous progress? She answered yes. That was at page 93 in the record. And what's important here, Your Honors, is there is no evidence submitted by the respondents to prove my client's current mental state or that mental state prevents her from parenting in the future. That was admitted in cross-examination, and it's in the record at page 104. And under this court's decision in NRACW, that is required.
Quickly, before you sit down, if I could have a moment, can you address the grounds of neglect and abandonment very quickly?
Yes, yes.
Which are alternatives?
Yeah, you're talking about the financial support aspect and
yes.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. Now, the record is clear that while my client was at the Oaks, as we all know, after she gave birth, she then moved to a group home facility at the Oaks, and she was there for a year. While she was at the Oaks, she was unable to provide financial support for the children. Her entire check went to the Oaks and to pay for her care. But even though she couldn't provide financial support, she still bought outfits for the children. She still provided them with clothing and food and snacks whenever she met with them. And we have the testimony in the record that it was more often than not she would do this on the visits. That's at page 43 of the transcript. And the burden under Missouri law, if a parent is unable to pay, the duty is to pay what you can. Evidence of minimal contributions show intent to continue the relationship. And that's exactly what we have here. She showed the intent to continue the relationship and provided what she could while she was turning her life around.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from you in a moment.
Thank you.
Before you get started, would you run through the number of grounds on which the trial court found a basis to terminate parental rights? It was?
As part of my argument or prior to that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Part of your argument right now.
Yes,
you
Your
start
Honor.
Here.
I'm happy to do that for you. Thank you.
Yeah.
May it please the court. The question specific to me at this point is the grounds that the court found to terminate parental rights. And I would submit to you under Chapter 211, the grounds the court found were that the children had been neglected by the natural mother. And the court made the necessary findings. Under that ground, the court found clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that the children had been under the juvenile court jurisdiction for a period of 1 year. The conditions which led to the assumption of jurisdiction still persisted, or conditions of a potentially harmful nature continued to exist.
Well, that's the statute. What?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. You'll go ahead and talk about the evidence in support of each one after you list them.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
The court also found the natural mother was unfit. And the court also found that there was a presumption that the natural mother was unfit. Under Chapter 453, the court found that the natural mother's consent to the adoption was not necessary due to her neglect of the minor children in the 6 months immediately preceding the filing of the petition for adoption, which would allow for the adoption to be entered without her consent, which would effectively terminate the mother's rights as well.
So four grounds or three grounds under the statutes?
Yeah, I apologize, I didn't count. We have
neglect, years, abandonment,
neglect, and unfitness.
And failure to rectify?
Yes, Your Honor.
May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just to clarify for the court, since there are going to be three of us arguing, my name is Sarah Genther. I was the attorney for the petitioners in the adoption action that were prosecuting the adoption and the termination of parental rights action. Due to the extensive effort that the guardian ad litem and the juvenile officer had in that role and in this appeal, they are here today requesting some time to speak to the court. It will be my intention to talk to the court about the distinction between the termination of parental rights and the court's finding that the mother's consent to the termination of her parental rights or her consent to the adoption was not necessary under Chapter 453. I will also intend to discuss with the court the grounds that the court found and the evidence that supported those grounds, and will defer to the guardian ad litem, Ms. Wheel, who has prepared to discuss with the court the constitutionality of the presumption of unfitness, and then if there's time, Mr. Cordy would like to address the court as well. Your Honor, we are asking today that this court affirm the trial court's judgment in its entirety, but would submit to this court that in the event that you were to find some error in the judgment, that the adoption in this action must still stand. In the case that's before the court, the trial court made findings, as I've stated, that the natural mother's consent to the adoption was not necessary due to her neglect of the minor children in the 6 months prior to the filing of the adoption action. The court found multiple grounds for termination of parental rights under Chapter 211. And further, the court found that termination is in the children's best interest, in that the appellant has only challenged the trial court's findings as to the 211 grounds. We're asking that the court affirm the adoption.
You rely on the same evidence under 453 that you rely on under 211.447, though, right?
To some extent, Your Honor. Specifically, with respect to 453, we did in this particular case ask the court or the witnesses, the caseworker, the parent aides, the adoptive petitioners, to address specifically any support that was provided during the six-month time period prior to the filing of the adoption. And then with respect to the Chapter 211 neglect issues, any amount of support that she had provided.
Opposing counsel said that she was unable to provide support during the time she was in the Oaks, and that was up to about 6 months before the termination. Is that right?
Yes.
So do you agree with that? Did her entire check go to the Oaks so she had no money left over?
Your Honor, I would agree that to some extent that the natural mother testified that her money was going to the Oaks and that she didn't have money. I don't believe that there is any additional evidence to support that. And I would also submit to the court that her placement at the Oaks was a voluntary placement. That's where she was residing. Those were the choices that she made. Certainly, at some point, she decided to move into a different apartment where presumably she felt as though she had additional funds to provide support for the children.
Did not you have the burden to prove that she had the ability to pay but failed to pay? So her not presenting evidence, is that relevant?
I think to the extent that she was claiming that all of her income was being used in providing money to stay in the Oaks, and that was a voluntary situation that she was in, one that she sought to rectify prior to the trial and the action. I think to that extent, it goes to her ability to provide support. Certainly, it was our burden to demonstrate that she had not, and in this case...
What was the evidence as to her income and her ability to pay?
Her income, the evidence was to her testimony regarding her disability income that she receives.
She testified she got a check for, I know the record shows what it was, I can't recall, was it $1,000 or some?
I think it was something shy of that, Your Honor.
And she did make a couple of payments on behalf of all her children, I think $200 payments on behalf of the five children after she moved into an apartment.
She also had provided, throughout the pendency of the case, three outfits apiece for the children. And that was the totality of the provision of support for the children, which, in my opinion, would demonstrate to the court almost a complete lack of support for the children, the payments that she made immediately prior to the trial and the outfits that she provided. I think the parent who testified that there were times that she didn't provide her provisions, necessities for the children, to include diapers, even at the visits. So I think that the evidence is clear that she may not have had a tremendous amount of money, but she didn't even make a token amount of payment for financial support for the children to demonstrate her intent to do so.
Did the court also take judicial notice of the record in the prior proceeding terminating her rights to her three older children?
Yes,
that was held 3 months earlier?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was there any evidence there as to her disability payments or other sources of income and so forth?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't recall off the top of my head regarding the evidence in that case, and I would have to reference the judgment with respect to that. I apologize.
Can you address the question of whether the mental health exam was sufficiently current and what evidence the court had to base its determination of her current mental status in the absence of a more recent mental exam?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the mental condition, there, as the court is aware, there were two psychological evaluations that had been done in the years that the natural mother had been working with the Children's Division. They were basically consistent in what they indicated. There was also evidence before the court regarding her treatment at Rediscover and at Truman that addressed her mental condition and any amount of progress that she was making and how that impacted her ability to even live independently, let alone take care of two young children. The evidence that the court had as of the time of the hearing to address the mental condition included the testimony of the hearing aid, the testimony of the caseworker, the natural mother's own testimony, which was difficult at times, and I think the court made note of that in their findings. I know this court has previously had similar factual scenarios before in the matter of QAH. In that case, the circumstances were very similar. The natural mother had lost custody in August of 2009. Shortly thereafter, there had been a psychological evaluation. The TPR was held in that matter in September of 2012, and the court received the 2009 psychological evaluation, heard evidence from both the mother's present psychiatrist and the mother's therapist, who at that time indicated they were of the opinion that the mother was capable of caring for the child. The court did not find that evidence credible, and this court upheld those findings, indicating that the court's finding that the mother had a mental condition which rendered her unable to knowingly provide the child with the necessary care was sufficient in that the court had considered evidence of her condition at that time. And I think that the record in this matter is clear that while there was not an updated psychological evaluation, that there wasn't a need for one as well. She had longstanding mental health conditions, had been in treatment for a significant period of time, and was still dealing with those issues.
I didn't mean to take you past your allocated time. So.
That's fine, Your Honor. Thank you. If the court doesn't have any further question for me, I will defer to Ms. Wheel and allow her to address some issues as well. Thank you.
May it please the court. Thank you. I'm here today to argue that the presumption of unfitness is constitutional, but first I would offer to the court that it is not necessary for this court at this time to address the issue of constitutionality of the presumption because the amount of evidence supporting the other grounds for termination is overwhelming and met the clear, cogent, and convincing standard necessary. In addressing the constitutionality of the presumption, time permitting, I would like to address four different areas. First, the standard of review that this court should apply when looking at the presumption of unfitness. Second, I would like to address the fact that this presumption is narrowly tailored. Third, that this presumption is established within Missouri law. And fourth, that there's persuasive authority both in Kansas and Minnesota that address this presumption or a similar presumption in those jurisdictions' set of laws. First, the standard of review, as articulated by my opposing counsel, I would mostly agree with. I do agree, and I am not contesting that a parent's rights to parent their child is not a fundamental right. I would say it is a fundamental right, and I think that's very clearly established both in Missouri and federal law. However, just because there is a fundamental right to something does not mean that it cannot be infringed upon. The standard that this court should apply when looking at the constitutionality of this presumption of unfitness is that it should find it constitutional unless it clearly and undoubtedly violates the Constitution. Any doubts must be resolved in favor of validity. So should this court decide to address the constitutionality, that's a high burden for appellant to prove that this particular presumption is unconstitutional. I would also submit that this court should apply strict scrutiny and that any infringement upon a parent's fundamental right to parent their child should be narrowly tailored to support a compelling state interest. Opposing counsel points to Santosky versus Kramer as a source for them, which establishes the grounds necessary for termination of a parent's parental rights. And I would also point to that case to indicate that one of the things they pointed to was the need for fundamentally fair procedures in order to address a parent's rights. I would argue, second, that the presumption of unfitness is narrowly tailored. It is narrowly tailored to parents who have been involuntarily terminated according to certain provisions within Missouri law within the last 3 years. So this means that in the last 3 years, another trial court has evaluated the parent's ability to safely parent his or her child and made a prospective, future-looking determination that that parent was not able to safely care for a child. That parent, in that previous case, was afforded due process and the opportunity to challenge any unfavorable evidence. So this presumption applies to a certain subset of people. It does not relieve the procedural safeguards for the presumption and for termination under 211. It requires the state or the petitioner to continue to prove that the termination is in the best interest of the child, and finally, it's a rebuttable presumption.
But it's sufficient to meet their burden to make a submissible case by itself.
I would agree. I would say in most cases before the Missouri courts, that particular piece of evidence is not the only thing that is offered. There are cases that where that is an issue.
Does it just shift the burden of going forward, but does the ultimate proof still remain with the state?
Yes.
Or does it just mean so there has to be some opposing evidence and then it drops out? Or is it an actual presumption that, what is the effect of this presumption?
So Missouri law requires,
How do you rebut it?
Yes. Missouri law requires that the parents indicate either that the conditions that led to the prior termination no longer exist, or that the parent is currently fit, is no longer unfit, I believe is the term that is used in our law. And I believe...
But you're saying the burden shifts to them to prove that as opposed to just there's some evidence on one side and they can present evidence on the other side.
I do believe that it shifts the burden. I believe that's the purpose of a presumption. Yes.
Well, there's two different kinds.
Yes.
You're conceding it's a rebuttable presumption, though. So
I am.
And in this case, the parent offered some evidence in an attempt to rebut it, correct?
Yes, I would.
And then,
agree.
Do we know whether or not the trial court found that the presumption was rebutted or not?
I'm sorry?
Do we know whether or not the trial court found the presumption was rebutted or not?
Correct. And this trial court did not find that the presumption had been rebutted. And I believe that there was a wealth of evidence before the court to demonstrate that even without the presumption that this particular parent was unfit to parent her twin baby girls.
Opposing counsel argues the presumption colored the rest of the proceedings and influenced the judge and his findings on other grounds. Can you address that?
I would disagree with opposing counsel. I think that the judge was able enough to distinguish between the presumption and the other evidence that was presented before the court. I don't think that there's any indication that the court simply rested on its laurels and relied on the presumption when making an evaluation of the evidence. I see that I am out of time. I would ask that the court affirm the trial court's decision and find the constitutional, and find the presumption of unfitness constitutional. Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to pick up right where you left off on the burden of proof. Under the Missouri statute, once it is established that you've had the prior termination within the preceding 3 years, the burden of proof under the presumption shifts to the parent, and it is the parent's burden to prove that they are not currently unfit to parent. That is clear in the statute and in the application, in the case law, and that is why it is unconstitutional. Now, shifting back to what you heard at the start of the respondent's argument, they briefly touched on the fact that they believe you can affirm the judgment even if you find that the termination was improper, because they claim under 453.0407 that the consent was not required and the court had findings on this. Your Honors, that point is wrong for several reasons. First and foremost, this court in CMVR, a 2011 decision, said very clearly that when 211 termination is pled as part of a 453 claim, you have to meet the requirements of 211.
As to any of the requirements of 211, though, wasn't it distinguishing if you're going under sub 8, which requires you to prove Chapter 211 grounds, then of course you have to meet all the requirements of 211. I'm not sure where you get from that language that it was suggesting you had to do that under sub 7, which does not refer to 211. It just says as to the 211.
And I understand your question, Your Honor, and the court was clear that if you have 453 alone, 453 only applies unless it is cross-referenced in 211. But then the court went the next step and said in the opinion, when 211 is pled, the requirements of 211 must be met. And I believe that was because it is the 211 termination that renders consent unnecessary.
Under 8, that's it, but not under 7.
It can be under 7 as well. And in fact, if you look at the trial court's judgment in this case, Your Honor, that's exactly what happened. On page 3 of the judgment, the court has the statutory language, and then at the end of the statutory language says, for the foregoing reasons, the mother's consent is unnecessary. Those foregoing reasons in the next 15 pages of the opinion was the termination under 211. That's what renders consent unnecessary. And it would be illogical to have a situation where this court would say the 211 termination was improper, but we're going to go ahead and allow the adoption. That makes absolutely no sense.
But if the other private adoption grounds were met, why would that not make sense?
Because you can't have a termination of the parental rights under 211. And they overlap, as Judge Stith pointed out in her questioning, they overlap so much that you would have conflicting findings.
Well, don't you have a reason the legislature might have had a lower standard in an adoption case than they would in a 211 termination, because there is in fact someone ready, willing, and seeking adoption? So the legislature has in subparagraph 7, they only have to abandon or neglect for a 6-month period.
I see my time is out. May I respond to your question?
Mm-hmm.
I agree completely. The legislature put that in there as an avenue when you truly have abandonment and the parents are not interested in the child.
Or neglect.
Or neglect. Exactly. You have that. And that can be done independently as 453, leaving 211 out completely. But when you bring in a petition, like we have here today that has 453 and 211, you then have to meet those 211 termination requirements. That's under CMBR, and that's how you determine that consent is unnecessary. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here today. The court based its entire decision off the 211 termination factors, and that's what we attacked.
I think what you're saying is the court didn't separately list out the factors under subsection 7, though it did refer to it, but it didn't list out any findings other, if it just referred back to its findings under 447. And so it's unclear if it was using those to support sub 7 or if it was saying it met sub 8 but didn't cite it, but it didn't make any separate findings under.
That is exactly correct, Your Honor, and that's something we included in our brief. I think it's clear that the court, by using for the foregoing reasons, was basing it off the 211 termination. And that's why the 211 termination takes up 15 pages of an 18-page opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you.